Hiya and welcome to Brain Injury Bites, where we provide help and advice for people after a brain injury. My name's Brooke and I've lived with a traumatic brain injury since 2007.
Hi, I'm Ashwini and I'm a trustee at Headway Warrington. I'm also a senior associate solicitor focusing on catastrophic injury, including brain injury.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Brain Injury Bites. Really good episode for you today. We've actually got my treating OT from back in, I don't know, 2008, 2009, 2010, was it? A long time ago anyway. Julie Meegan. For the benefits, obviously I know Julie. It's the first time I've seen her in about 10 years. Well, be it digitally. And for the benefit of everybody else, would you like to explain who you are, what you do, Julie?
Hi everyone. Hi, Brooke. It's absolutely lovely to see you again after 10 or 11 years. Yeah, my name's Julie Meegan. I'm a specialist brain injury occupational therapist, and I had the pleasure of working with Brooke about 11 years ago, I believe. So my job is really the best job in the world because I get to support people after brain injury in order to be able to be more independent, to have a good quality of life, and basically just to get back to being and doing all of the things that are important to them.
That's super. I think that's actually a really succinct summary and was kind of the answer to my next question, or one of my questions anyway, because, well, no, I think we can expand on this. So I think it'd be helpful to just kind of explain what occupational therapy actually is and dispel the myth that it's just arts and crafts and playing around with scissors and stuff. What is it that occupational therapists do with their clients?
Oh, that's such a massive question. So, yeah, so when I started OT, the myth was that we were bunny stuffers. So I don't know if any, or basket weavers was the other one. And that certainly comes from that arts and crafts background where people would sit around a table and do activities. And certainly that has a place in sort of the fundamentals of what OT is, because we believe that purposeful activity is very therapeutic and is actually essential for people's well-being. So how that's evolved over the years is that occupational therapists look to develop independent living skills mm-hmm. and quality of life in people who have, for some reason, difficulties with activities. So it could be that after an injury or illness, or it could be that the environment itself is just not suitable for or productive for the things they want to do. So what OTs look at really is the barriers to why somebody can't do the things that they want to do, and start to break that down into components. So it could be a physical problem, it could be a thinking or cognitive issue, or it could be an emotional problem, or it could be the environment itself is just not conducive to that activity. And then what we do is try and make changes, break that down into smaller goals, and build up from there so that eventually, hopefully, the individual can reach their goals. I think what OTs are really good at is working very closely with the person involved, and we're really keen on client-centered goals. So we don't set goals for people that aren't important to themselves, really.
Yeah, because I suppose that's the thing. If you want to achieve something, you have to be invested in it. So there's no point the therapist setting the goals and going, right, this is what you need to achieve, the individual themselves need to want to get there, and it has to be important to them to buy into the process.
Absolutely, it has to be meaningful. Otherwise, like you say, it's really hard to engage somebody who has no interest. It's the same for any of us, isn't it? You know, we talked we talked a little bit when we were sort of just setting up about Brooke running the Great North Run. Congratulations on your place, Brooke.
And I said,
congratulations on your place. Yeah, because I'm not motivated to do that. So I'm not going to get up every morning and train. If I was motivated to do that, I would be able to set that as a goal, and I would be able to put in place all of the little stages that build up that big goal. Mm-hmm. So for Brooke, I imagine he's going to be going out on a few early morning runs for a couple of Ks, and then building up the length and building up the distance. And that's how he's going to achieve that final goal. And that's the same really with any goal. It's just about breaking it down to the small step and taking that first step. And OTs are there to sort of break that down for people and to then support them to take that first step in a very safe, graded way. But then sort of, you know, gradually help people to sort of move slightly outside their comfort zone, but still with that safe structure there.
I guess that's really important, isn't it? That it's safe and graded, that you're not sort of doing too much too quickly, setting yourself up to fail, and then taking that one step forward and about 20 steps back.
No, absolutely. And that's really demoralizing. And again, that's the examples of that within everybody's lives, really, where you set a goal that's just sort of unrealistic. And that's the other thing that OTs are really, really eager to do with clients. So it's important that the client goals are their goals, but also that we help to make that realistic. And it could be just about taking that first step to that. So if you think of the goal about the running, you're not just going to be able to go out and run half a marathon, although that might be the ultimate goal. That needs to be smaller goals. So your first month's goal might be running 2.5K. So it's really important that we help people to understand the barriers and to understand some of the difficulties, but also set the smaller goals, because then when you achieve that goal, you feel really motivated and engaged, and that really helps propel the momentum. Mm-hmm. It's really important. It's like you say, if you set a goal that's too difficult and then immediately fail, that's really demoralizing and demotivating, which is the opposite of what we want to happen in a rehab setting.
Yeah, and particularly where with brain injury, you might already have problems with motivation and, planning and execution. So it's important to make sure that those steps are manageable and achievable.
Do you have to deal with a lot of people who obviously think they're better than they are, which I think was certainly the case with me? I didn't realise, I didn't want to admit the things that held me back.
Yes, absolutely. It's very common thread when you work with people who've had a brain injury, that insight can be a tricky issue, and that people don't always see some of the difficulties that they've got and maybe do set themselves slightly unrealistic goals because of that. But that's also part of the therapy process, working together to gently provide that feedback so that people can get that awareness and insight, because that helps you then to use the tools that you need to achieve your goals. If you don't know that there's anything that can be helped, then you're not going to take on board advice and strategies. So it is important that you're able to work together, to have that relationship, that trust and relationship, where you can give honest feedback, but again, in that really safe, graded way, so that you still feel like you're progressing and not demoralised. But yeah, you're absolutely right, Brooke. Insights are a real difficulty sometimes.
Do you find that some people actually never get it back? Like sometimes I think, what are we, 15, 16 years on now, I don't think I fully, I'll say I'm 95% there, but I still think I can do more than I actually can. But I think it's some that pushes me to do things in some ways that I wouldn't ever otherwise do, which I think it can be a good and a bad thing in some ways.
I think you've answered that question far better than I can, Brooke, because I work with people for possibly a couple of years, and then usually our sessions will come to an end, and then that person carries on their journey without me. And that's really interesting to hear that even, after a couple of years of therapy, that you're still learning things about yourself and still learning some of the strengths and difficulties. So I think you've answered that question perfectly. To be honest, I couldn't answer any better.
So I think it'd be helpful to kind of think about some of the specific areas in which brain injury affects somebody's ability to carry out things like activities of daily living and just general independent living tasks, and how you work with those issues, the sort of goals that you set or the steps that you look at to help people along the way in gaining or regaining rather that independence. I mean, we've talked about through the series, we've talked about different issues such as, organisation, planning, execution, memory problems, fatigue. And I guess with all of those, there are lots of different ways in which you can work with your clients to help them get to where they need to be. I mean, do you want to sort of talk us through some of the strategies that you would use in those areas?
Well, absolutely. I think the things that OTs do is use function really as the main strategy and the main treatment plan. So rather than writing a goal around an impairment such as difficulty with organising or planning, we would look at what actually does that stop that person doing that they want to do, and again bringing it back to that client-centred goal. So for example, if we were talking about fatigue management, which is a huge goal for most people following a brain injury, or a lot of people following a brain injury, We would look at what it was that that person wanted to do that fatigue was stopping. So I had a client who wanted to sit in the garden with her husband and listen to the birds on an early evening, but she was so sleepy and tired that she was in bed really early. So that was her goal, was to be able to stay up till 9 o'clock, which is a real sort of functional goal. You know when you've achieved it. Then obviously what we had to do is break that down into smaller steps and to really analyse what was happening in that day to stop, to prevent that lady from achieving that goal. So really, no matter what the impairment, the important thing is to think about what the actual goal is for the client. And then obviously within that, analysing the difficulties and the strengths, which is really important. It's not all looking at negatives. It's what can that person do that can help with the things that aren't so easy. And then, you know, there's lots of strategies OTs really love. You know, we what we try to do is give people the tools to be able to help themselves as well. And to learn how to manage impairments as they arise. So it really depends on what we're talking about. I mean, in preparation, I wrote a list. I thought, right, what is it that I do? What do I do with my clients? What's the most common things? And I actually just sort of ran out of paper because,
wow,
you know, we do, you know, washing and dressing, being able to shampoo your hair, being able to blow dry your hair, cooking, meal planning your week, remembering appointments, medication, going back to college, going back to work, sleep, managing fatigue. And all of these things have so many elements to them. There's a physical element to everything we do, you know, sort of moving our limbs, being able to coordinate, having strength and dexterity, and also sort of how we plan a task, how we actually initiate it in the first place, how we get up off the chair and start to do our daily things, and how we self-monitor. You know, how do we know we're doing a good job? How do we know if we've made mistakes? How do we know if we're finished a task? And then obviously the emotional aspect of tasks. You know, if they interest us, if they upset us, if we're anxious, if we're worried. So all of these things in every single goal is something that we would analyse and then look at the first step to that and then start building in strategies to help people to get to that first step. So if it was things like weekly planning, you know, we would look at helping the client with a diary and in a paper planner and really looking to see where we can put appointments in at the best times, asking clients to review these things like whiteboards. We just use so many different strategies and it really, really depends on the client and the client's interests and how they adapt to what you're suggesting. Some clients really love sort of a physical paper, you know, this is what I do, this is what I need to do in this situation. Other clients really like just to practice the physical and practice it in a session over and over again until that's, you know, that's sort of reinforced as their strategy.
One thing I've come back to recently is what we used to do about the, you know, planning like the meals of the week, what you're going to eat throughout the week, which is Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and you've what you get for breakfast, your lunch, your dinner, and then you then put that on a piece of paper and you'd go out and buy shopping accordingly so you didn't like buy too much stuff and, you know, walk around the supermarket and grab random things and end up with a load of stuff left in your fridge at the end of it.
And that's such a good example, Brooke, because also some people might just go to the supermarket without a list or without a plan and buy lots of items that don't necessarily go together for a meal and then sort of come home and think, oh, I've got nothing to eat. So being able to do that planning before you go to a supermarket is really important, and it guides the shopping list, but also it guides kind of your route through the supermarket as well.
We used to do that. We used to plan, I think it was Tesco in Scarborough, wasn't it? And most supermarkets, it's fruit and veg first, and there's tins, and there's the fresh stuff, and so you're not snaking around the supermarket. And
so setting
stuff out
your list in accordance with the order
exactly,
you go.
Yeah,
okay, yeah.
So that really helps with route finding and attention, and also sort of limiting impulsivity. So some people find it really hard not to buy everything that they want. They might be on a tight budget, or it might just be that they buy quite a lot of food that then goes to waste.
Bags of salad. That's a problem with everyone, I think, though, isn't it? Bags of salad.
Yeah.
Yeah, bags of salad always in the bottom of the bin. Yeah. Yeah, so that's a really good example again, Brooke, of things that we did together that was really helpful in terms of maintaining your attention and impulsivity, making sure as well that you weren't spending too long in the supermarket, because it can be quite a tiring environment. I hope you don't mind me saying this, but one of the things we really worked on together was fatigue management. That's what I remember we spent a lot of time working on. And supermarkets in places like that can be really fatiguing for people with after a brain injury, because they're very busy with people.
One thing that people like who don't have a head injury don't get, how a supermarket can tire you out, because you've got like the bright lights, you've got the noise, you know, if it's got music in supermarkets. Yeah. And then, you know, if you meet somebody, then that can totally send you off track.
And if you think that some people after a brain injury have problems with information processing.
Yeah.
So if you think about a supermarket, it's a really overwhelming situation to be in terms of the information that's flooding in. So you've got lots of people coming at you from all angles. You've got so many products on the shelf. You've got usually some music jangling away as well, and people chattering. And also you're trying to concentrate and think about the things that you need to get on with as well. So I think that's a great example. So something like a meal planner and a shopping list, as well as making sure you've got food, which is really important, actually then really helps with fatigue management. Because it means you're going to stick to that task, you're going to get round the supermarket in the length of time that it needs to take, and you can spend your energy on other things in the day that are more interesting than the Tesco shop.
I just wanted to come back to the example you gave before, and obviously without breaching any kind of confidence, but you spoke about the lady who wanted to sit in her garden like at 9 o'clock with her husband. Did she manage to achieve that goal? And if so, what were the sort of steps that you identified? What was the kind of process to get her there?
So yes, she did achieve that goal, and it's a lot of the time it's a little bit of investigation between yourself and the client to sort of build up a picture of somebody's day and all of the things that they're doing in that day. So in that situation, the person really struggled to sleep. So that meant that her whole sleep pattern affected what else happened in the day. So for example, if she was awake late into the night, she would then oversleep the next day, and then she would wake up tired, and then she would struggle to sleep.
Sounds like a story of my life, that.
Well, yes, and that's really sort of not the sleep advice that's thought to be the best now. So she would sleep for extended periods during the day and quite late into the day. And really what was happening was just her energy levels and fatigue levels were not consistent. So what we really tried to do is get a really consistent sleep and wake cycle, you know, setting someone a goal of going to bed at whatever time, you know, seems reasonable, and building that up. And then looking at what happens in the day and trying to eliminate long sleeps. So you can have sort of incorporating small rest periods throughout the day before, say 2 p.m. to try and sort of manage that fatigue without the extended times in bed. So really, fatigue management, I could do a whole podcast just on fatigue management, in all honesty. But basically, you know, your three P's: you need to plan, you need to pace your activities, you need to prioritise your activities.
I'm writing this down.
Oh, well, yeah, honestly, fatigue management's a separate podcast, the three P's. And it's really looking at everything that happens in that day. And it's so complicated. It's, you know, just, do people take medication? Are they in pain? What's their sleep hygiene like? Do they drink a lot of caffeine? Yeah. Do they drink alcohol before bed? Do they eat a meal before bed? Is their bedroom comfortable? Is the room dark and cool? There's basics that in sleep hygiene that some people just don't realise are so important and fundamental to their sleep. And it's only following something like a brain injury that it becomes really apparent, because sleep is so important. And, you know, that's when we start to look really closely at sleep hygiene. It's something that you don't really, you know, actually quite recently there's been quite a lot of interest in it, hasn't there, about sleep hygiene and the importance of sleep and for everybody, sleep is so important, and making sure that you get your 8 hours or whatever's recommended.
Oh dear. I think I'm on 5.
Yeah, 8 hours would be lovely. But yeah, it was something that obviously had just used to happen so naturally, and I had no problem with was sleep until I had this injury, and it became the bane of my life. People used to say that, and then you used to get people giving you advice like, you sleep through the day, and you don't sleep well at night.
Yeah, so the thinking is if you have a long sleep during the day, then that's going to stop you falling asleep easily at night. It's going to affect your nighttime sleep.
It's something that I've had to put in place, like make myself no sleeps, probably 3 o'clock's my limit, no caffeine after 12 o'clock. And that's something I've stuck to. And honestly, I notice that if I do have, like, you know, in one of them nights when you're awake at 4 o'clock in the morning and you like start going through your day, oh yeah, I had a cup of coffee at 2 o'clock. And that's I don't know if it's exactly 12, but it seems to be, that's
I guess
safe.
A lot of it is probably like trial and error, isn't it? Like you probably had to work out over a period of time that actually if I sleep during the day at a certain point, I'm not going to get to sleep at night. Or if I have coffee at this time, I'm not going to get to sleep at night.
The problem with trial and error though is like, you know, if you go to bed at, I don't know, rest at like 3 o'clock, one day and it affects your sleep on the night, then the next night you've probably forgotten about the 3 o'clock the next day. That's why writing down is so valuable.
It is, and that's why you also need a good OT, because that's part of a really good sleep program, Brooke, where it is in a way a trial and error, but what's important is that you try one aspect at a time and see if it makes a difference. For example, not everybody's going to want to go to bed at 10 o'clock, so it's no good just giving blanket advice everybody goes to bed at 10 o'clock. So we can give general advice on things like caffeine. Probably 2 p.m is probably the best time to have your last coffee, and no sleep over 45 minutes. But then what's important is to work with the person to say, okay, what's going to work for you and what do you want to try first.
No more than 3 cups of coffee in a day as well.
I can only do 2. That's what I've learned. And a colleague once gave me a can of Pepsi Max and told me there was no caffeine in it. And I drank it about 8 o'clock at night and stared at the ceiling all evening. So, you know, I've learned that lesson the hard way, that Pepsi Max certainly does have caffeine in. But yeah, so what we would do, I mean, for example, Brooke, I don't know if you remember, but the first thing we did was set a specific bedtime and wake time and agreed between us that we would create this sort of experiment. And that if Brooke got up at, for example, 8 o'clock every day, even if he felt he hadn't slept well, and then we would review that in the next session. And I think that's the important part, that you get that review process, because it is so difficult to keep changing aspects of and you got to remember that if I'm involved in looking at your sleep, it's because there's a problem with it. It's because it needs, you know, it needs addressing. And it's about untangling all of those different threads of why that sleep's gone wrong and trying to help with that. And you can't just change everything at once because it's too big. So it's about saying what's reasonable to try first. And then if you try something that you've got a pretty good success rate at, then it's much more likely that you're going to put the next step in place and the next step in place and the next step in place. And the other thing to say is that, you know, with sleep, it is really complex, and fatigue after brain injury is different to what we would describe as, you know, feeling tired, I'll go to bed, I'll wake up, I'll feel refreshed. Brooke would describe times when he felt really fatigued and really felt like the shutters had just come down, and he felt ill. It wasn't a case of just feeling tired, it was feeling of this, I've stopped, I've shut down. And then that might actually go on for more than one day. So it wouldn't be that one night's sleep was enough to completely recharge the battery. It would kind of have a hangover effect for a couple of days.
That was one thing it took me a while to get used to. Like before that, if you went to bed, it would just totally reset everything. But it was just the fact that it didn't, and it would carry on to the next day. You're absolutely right there.
Your 3 P's are really, really important, because once you know that about yourself, because what I always say to people about fatigue is fatigue management isn't about stopping you doing things. It's about allowing you to do more things. It might mean that you have to shift the times that you do them. So the 3 P's, you need to plan out what it is that you want to do. So, if Brooke said to me, well, I want to go to the pub quiz, I want to have like a couple of pints, but I know I'm going to be absolutely wiped for 2 days, but it's really important to me, then we would look at a weekly planner and say, well, okay, that happens there. What happens the day before? Oh, well, I could have a quiet day. So you could actually sort of save up a little bit, you know, not do anything too strenuous so that your fatigue levels are quite good by the time you get to that place. And then what's the next day look like? Can we have an easy day that day? Are there jobs that you need to do that aren't going to have a high fatigue cost? And again, that's the pacing element. And then the last P, the prioritising, what needs to be done? What can be delegated? What can be left to another time? So really helping somebody have an overview of the whole week so that the important parts get the focus. And that's one of the important things that I know I worked with Brooke on with fatigue management. And I think at the time you were at college as well, Brooke.
I started that fitness course, didn't I, at college?
It was really fatiguing. You think about all that new learning and meeting new people and having sort of, the cognitive aspect of learning new information, but also the emotional of meeting new people and physical, having to get to college, get up out of bed and get to college. It was a big ask.
I went to college and I did, it was a gym instructors, level 2 gym instructors course I did. It was 1 day a week, but it was a full day a week. So my dad used to have this camper van and he gave us a lift to work, to college in the camper van. He took his bike in the back of it. He used to cycle home and he left me with the car keys. And on the lunchtime, I'd go in the camper van and get my head down for half an hour and have my lunch in there.
I remember that. Yeah. It worked really well, didn't it? Because you kind of needed to be away from people who were going to chatter to you and ask, what have you got for lunch and how did you find that? You kind of needed the quiet.
And at break times, they give me let me go in a dark room and just shut my eyes. But it's just like, not everybody knows that much about brain injury, especially fatigue management. So there was people just walking in and they were like, oh my god, who's that this strange guy sat in the middle of the room like that getting 40 winks. But it's been fatigue has been absolutely the worst thing I've suffered with. Going back to what he said about carrying on day by day, one thing that I haven't done it for a while, but I probably still would do is if I have a particularly fatiguing day, I used to write myself a note for the next morning to read on my bedside table that I'm going to be tired. Quite often I'd completely forget what I'd done the next day, especially if I'd done something quite strenuous. It would totally wipe my memory. I'd wake up and I'd be absolutely exhausted, and that would lead into a real morning of depression. So if I read the note that I was going to be exhausted, I was going to be a bit depressed, and I'd plan some light activities to do on that morning, that really helped. Preparation, one of the 3 P's.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's absolutely a great example of how you've sort of taken the strategies we used to use and adapted them over time, because what we would have done is written out a weekly planner and said, okay, that's going to be a tiring day. So you know when you look at this planner all week that's coming up and what you're going to do the next day. So you obviously don't need that level of planning now, but that little post-it note's just enough to remind you that it's okay, you're gonna feel fatigued today. Just take it easy and don't let it, don't let it affect your mood, because the next day is going to be different again. So that's a lovely example of how sort of you've adapted strategies and made them your own. And I think the other thing to remember about fatigue is it's so important because it affects so many other areas of your life.
Yeah.
So once you get to a level of fatigue, all your other impairments will become much worse. So when you're fatigued, your memory will be worse, your attention will be worse. And one of the things we really try to help people understand is that they're symptoms of fatigue. So a lot of people don't know that they get fatigued until they reach a level where actually it's gone a little bit too far. So if you can recognise those first little symptoms of fatigue, I call them like poker tells, like everybody has a tell. So with some people, it's they blink or they yawn, or for some people
they rub their eyes.
You just notice that they're not paying attention, or they might sort of ask for sorry, what did you say there? So everybody, and it's really important that you sort of have that knowledge about yourself, because if you can at that point say, oh, okay, yeah, I recognise this, I need to go off and have 10 minutes in a dark room or 10 minutes just looking out the window, then you're more likely to come back to that activity and have enough to energy to get it done. What we don't want is people to go past the point of no return.
I can totally relate to that point of no return, yeah.
And we used to talk about this, Brooke, all the time. We used to call it boom and bust, where, you're doing something, you're writing an assignment, and I don't want to stop, Julie, because I'm in the flow, I'm in the zone, and yes, I'm tired, and yes, I'm feeling myself getting really fatigued, but I'm going to finish.
And you go too far.
In bed for 2 days, assignment doesn't get finished. So it's really important, sort of that recognition of, oh yeah, this is where I need to stop and have a rest. It actually helps you be more productive in the long run.
I've always equated to myself to like a mobile phone, in that you if you keep plugging yourself in, as in for a short period of time, it makes your battery keep going. But if I let my battery go to the bottom, then you can't just plug it back in. You have to wait like 10 minutes for it to go again. Fatigue is more of an extreme version of that. Like if I totally exhaust myself, then it takes me like a couple of days to get back on track. Whereas if I keep myself on that level with, you know, with short rests, then I can keep going.
That's a great analogy. And it is, you're right. It's an analogy we use quite a lot, because if you let your phone run out of charge, it is unusable. It does not work.
Yeah.
If you keep it topped up, you've always got a phone. So it's exactly the same principle. You're right, yeah.
Thank you for listening to part one. We hope you can join us for part two. Please don't forget to follow, subscribe and share our content. If you do have any suggestions for topics that you'd like us to cover, why not drop us a line at hi@braininjurybites.co.uk.